It was the 3rd of September, that day I'll always remember. Yes, I will. 'Cause that was the day that my daddy died. I never got a chance to see him. Never heard nothing but bad things about him. Mama, I'm depending on you to tell me the truth. Mama just hung her head and said, son, Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home. All he left us was alone. Oh, Papa was a rolling stone, my son, yeah. Wherever he laid his hat was his home. Only left us well alone. Well, well. Hey, Mama, is it true what they say that Papa never worked a day in his life?
And Mama, some bad talk going around town saying that Papa had 3 outside children and another wife. And that ain't right.
Heard some talk about Papa doing some storefront preaching, talking about saving souls and all the time leeching, dealing in debt and stealing in the name of the Lord. Mama just hung her head and said, Papa was a rolling stone, my son. Wherever he laid his hat was his home. And when he died, all he left us was alone. Hey, Papa was a rolling stone. That gummit, wherever he laid his hat was his home. And when he died, all he left us was alone.
Hey, Mama, I heard Papa call himself a jack of all trades. Tell me, is that what sent Papa to an early grave? Folks say Papa would beg, borrow, steal to pay his bills.
Hey, Mama, folks say Papa never was much on thinking. Spent most of his time chasing women and drinking.
Mama!
Mama looked up with a tear in her eye and said, son,
well, 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 hey, yeah. All he left us was alone, 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 alone. Yes, he was my son. All he left us was alone. My daddy was. Yes, he was. Hey, yeah.
I'm going to start with a story which was told by the American cartoonist Al Capp. The story is about a creature called the Shmoo. The Shmoo was 10 inches high, something like a pear in shape, and a beautiful creamy white in color. It had no arms, tiny feet, and big whiskers under its nose. The Shmoo had only one desire, to serve the needs of human beings, and it was well equipped to do so. Its skin could be made into any kind of fabric. Its flesh was edible. Its dead body could go brick hard and be used for building, and its whiskers, well, its whiskers had more uses than you can imagine. If you looked at a shmoo with real hunger in your eye, it dropped dead in rapture because you wanted it, after first cooking itself into your favorite flavor. Well, since they multiplied rapidly, there were plenty of shmoos for everybody, and they even looked good in the environment. Almost everyone approved of the shmoos. But some people weren't keen on them. The rich capitalists hated the schmooze. Since schmooze provided everything people needed, nobody had to work for capitalists anymore, because nobody had to make the wages to buy the things capitalists sold. And so, as the schmooze spread across the face of America, the capitalists began to lose their position and their power, and this made them take drastic action. They got the government to tell the people that the schmoo was un-American. The schmoo was causing chaos, undermining the social order. People weren't turning up for work, and they weren't going to the department stores to buy anything. Well, the government propaganda convinced the people, and the president ordered the FBI to gather the schmooze and gun them down. Then things went back to normal. But a country lad called Little Abner managed to save one female and one male schmoo. He carried them off to a distant valley where he hoped they'd be safe. "Folks ain't yet ready for the schmoo," Little Abner sighed. But Little Abner was wrong. Folks were ready for the schmoo. It was only the capitalists that weren't. The capitalists didn't like the schmoo because it gave people independence. And when people don't depend on them for work and for goods, capitalists lose their privileged place. People haven't always depended on capitalists. They never, of course, had schmooz, but they did have land, and the things they get from schmooz in Al Capp's story, they got by working the land in pre-capitalist history. It's true that they didn't keep everything they produced on the land. Monarchs and their hangers-on and various lords and ladies were usually able to take quite a bit of their product. But the people didn't depend for their survival on any superiors until, after a long history of forced expropriation and plain and crooked dealing, they found themselves without any resources for producing things except their own labor. And in order to survive, they had to hire themselves out to capitalists, who now had all the other resources. So we got a new setup, and in this new setup, workers sold their labor and capitalists bought it, and the buyers treated the sellers as nothing but sources of profit. So when the buyers didn't need all the labor that was offered, some workers were denied employment. And since they had no land or schmooze to live off, they became beggars and vagabonds and inmates of workhouses, or they simply wasted away. Well, of course, things aren't quite that bad now. Capitalism isn't as pure and ruthless as it used to be. The dispossessed workers defended themselves by uniting in trade unions. And the coming of the welfare state, with its public provision of necessities, means that workers don't depend for everything they need on finding someone who wants to buy their labor. The trade unions and the welfare state were savagely resisted by the capitalists, but they've come to stay. Now, advocates of pure capitalism describe it as a system in which people freely exchange their own private property. Socialists deny the freedom and fairness of that exchange. They complain that some are able to bring vast assets to market, while most people have nothing to sell except their own capacity to work. That's the socialist complaint. But against that socialist complaint, lots of capitalists will say, "Hang on a minute, wait a second. It's true that I have vast assets now, but I started with practically nothing except my own talent and courage, and it was by using them that I made my pile. You can't talk about lack of fairness. I had no unfair advantage in the race for wealth." Well, the socialist might reply that it's pretty rare these days for a capitalist to begin with brains and grit alone, but I want to focus here on just such self-made capitalists, since their wealth does look pretty legitimate. Well, if you think about that wealth, what's it made of? In its immediate form, it's just bits of paper, records and ledgers, share certificates, and so on. But the reason why those things are valuable is that they entitle their possessor to material resources, to raw and transformed parts of nature, to iron ore that's been turned into steel, to factories and energy and power lines and tracts of land and minerals under the sea. The capitalist is happy to tell us how he got all that stuff. He says, look, I got it through my own hard work and enterprise. I didn't get it from my parents. I didn't get it by stealing or cheating. But we can ask a deeper question, a question which is much more difficult for him to answer, a question which is prompted by the realization that everything he owns, everything, either is or was made of something which once was nobody's private property. The deep question is, how did it come to be anybody's private property in the first place? You see, the capitalist says that he got his wealth through free market exchange. And that means that he's defending his title to it by invoking the title of those who transferred it to him. But I'm asking, what was the source of their right to it? The fact that they got it from still earlier owners? Well, that kind of justification can't go on forever. Eventually, we're going to be pushed back to the very first private owners of land and the raw materials of nature. And they didn't get them from earlier legitimate owners. They simply took nature's resources. And I'm asking, what gave them the right, not merely to use the world, because that's okay, but to establish permanent, bequeathable private property in it, so that others could no longer use it freely? What gave them that right? The self-made capitalist explains how, through honest industry and straight dealing, he accumulated an enormous amount of private property. But why was there that private property to accumulate in the first place? No story about the exchange and accumulation of private property can justify the transformation of things into private property in the first place. The fact that the world's resources were once privately owned by nobody and then grabbed supports the socialist idea that they should be restored to the people as a whole. But now I want to look at a different line of defense of capitalism, which says, come on, forget about past history, let bygones be bygones, don't be obsessed with the misty origins of capitalism. It doesn't matter how capitalist property came into being. Whatever the origin of capitalism was, it's an excellent system, since even the poorest people do better under capitalism than they would in any other form of economy. Well, the argument for the idea that capitalism promotes human benefit is pretty familiar. It goes something like this. Capitalist firms survive only if they make money, and they make money only if they prevail in competition against other capitalist firms. Since that competition is severe, the firm to survive has to be efficient. If firms produce incompetently, they go under. So they have to seize every opportunity to improve their productive facilities and techniques so that they can produce cheaply enough to make enough money to go on. It's admitted in this justification of capitalism that the capitalist firm doesn't aim to satisfy people, but the firms can't get what they are aiming at, which is money, unless they do satisfy people, and satisfy them better than rival firms do. Well, I agree with part of this argument. Capitalist competition, it has to be acknowledged, has induced a remarkable growth in our power to produce things. But the argument also says that capitalism satisfies people, and I'm going to claim that the way the system uses technical progress generates widespread frustration, not satisfaction. My anti-capitalist argument starts with the very same proposition with which the argument praising capitalism begins, namely this proposition: the aim of the capitalist firm is to make as much money as it can. It isn't basically interested in serving anybody's needs. It measures its performance by how much profit it makes. Now, that doesn't prove straight off that it isn't good at serving needs. In fact, the case for capitalism that I expressed a moment ago might be put as follows. Competing firms trying not to satisfy needs, but to make money, will in fact serve our needs extremely well, since they can't make money unless they do so. Okay, that's the argument. But I'm now going to show that the fact that capitalist firms aren't interested in serving human needs does have harmful consequences. Recall that improvement in productivity is required if the firm's going to survive in competition. Now, what does improved productivity mean? It means more output for every unit of labor. And that means that you can do two different things when productivity goes up. One way of using enhanced productivity is to reduce work and extend leisure while producing the same output as before. Alternatively, output may be increased while labor stays the same. Now, let's grant that more output is a good thing. But it's also true that for most people, what they have to do to earn a living isn't a source of joy. Most people's jobs, after all, are such that they benefit not only from more goods and services, but also from a shorter working day and longer holidays. Just consider, if God gave all of us the pay we now get and granted us freedom to choose whether or not to work at our present jobs for as long as we pleased, but for no extra pay, then there'd be a big increase in leisure time pursuits. So improved productivity makes two things possible. It makes possible either more output or less toil, or of course some mixture of both. But capitalism is biased in favor of the first option only, increased output, since the other, reduction of toil, threatens a sacrifice of the profit associated with greater output and sales. What does a firm do when the efficiency of its production improves? Well, it doesn't just reduce the working day of its employees and produce the same amount as before. Instead, it makes more stuff. It makes more of the goods it was already making. Or if that isn't possible, because the demand for what it's selling won't expand, then it lays off part of its workforce and seeks a new line of production in which to invest the money it thereby saves. Eventually, new jobs are created and output continues to expand, although there's a lot of unemployment and suffering along the way. Now, the consequence of the increasing output which capitalism favors is increasing consumption. And so we get an endless chase after consumer goods just because capitalist firms are geared to making money and not to serving the interests of consumers. Alfred P. Sloan, who once ran General Motors in the United States, said that it was the business of the automobile industry to make money, not cars. I agree, and that, I'm saying, is why it makes so many cars. It would make far fewer if its goal weren't money, but, say, providing people with an efficient and an inoffensive form of transport. If the aim of production were the satisfaction of need, then rather less would be produced and consumed than is in fact produced and consumed. And most of us would lead less anxious lives and have more time and energy for the cultivation and enjoyment of our own powers. Now, I'm not some kind of fanatical Puritan who's against consumer goods. I'm not knocking consumer goods. Consumer goods are fine. But the trouble with the chase after goods in a capitalist society is that we'll always, most of us, want more goods than we can get, since the capitalist system operates to ensure that people's desire for goods is never satisfied. Business, of course, wants contented customers, but they mustn't become too contented, since when customers are satisfied with what they've got, they buy less and work less, and business dwindles. That's why in a capitalist society, an enormous amount of effort and talent goes into trying to get people to want what they don't have. That's why there's feverish product innovation, huge investments in sales and advertising, and planned obsolescence. In order to keep going as a system, capitalism has to keep people on the go, and it creates a great deal of strain and nervous tension. The Rockefellers make sure that the Smiths need to keep up with the Joneses, and in a forlorn attempt to keep up, because not everybody can manage to keep up, people work their lives away and sometimes take extra jobs in order to buy things they don't have the time to enjoy, because of the time they spend working to buy them. Well, in earlier periods of capitalist history, its preference for output conferred on the system a progressive historical role. Capitalism raised us above the scarcity imposed by nature under which pre-capitalist peasants labored. But as that natural scarcity recedes, the output preference renders capitalism reactionary. It can't realize the possibilities of liberation it creates. Having lifted the burden of natural scarcity, it contrives an artificial scarcity, which means that people never feel they have enough. Capitalism brings humanity to the very threshold of liberation and then locks the door. We get near it, but we remain on a treadmill, just outside it. Sometimes people fall off that treadmill, and recently in this country, that's happened on a large scale. I'm referring again to the problem of unemployment, which is now enormous in Britain. The same system that overworks people in the interest of profit also deprives them entirely of work when it's not profitable to employ them. And what we get as a result is not something that we could imagine, a reasonable amount of work and a balanced existence for everyone, but grotesque overemployment for some, together with rending unemployment for others. How can they say that this system satisfies human need when homeless people in Britain need housing and unemployed bricklayers need work? How can anybody think that it's a system that promotes human benefit when it projects the message that the only way to self-esteem is to be the owner of a BMW or at least a Ford Sierra? And then it throws millions of families into a destitution where they can barely afford sausages to feed their children. So I'm very skeptical about the claim that capitalism is so good at satisfying our needs as consumers. And anyway, people have needs which go beyond the need to consume. One of those needs will, because it's so important, occupy most of the rest of this talk. It's a person's need to develop and exercise his or her talents. When people's capacities lie unused, they don't enjoy the zest for life which comes when their faculties flourish. Now, people are able to develop themselves only when they get good education. But in a capitalist society, the education of children is threatened by those who seek to fit education to the narrow demands of the labor market. And some of them think that what's now needed to restore profitability to an ailing British capitalism is a lot of cheap, unskilled labor. And they conclude that education should be restricted to ensure that it'll supply that labor. The present Chancellor of the Exchequer, Nigel Lawson, said in a speech a couple of years ago that we should now think about training people for jobs which are, as he put it, not so much low-tech as no-tech. Now, what sort of education is contemplated in that snappy statement, not so much low-tech as no-tech? Not an education that nourishes the creative powers of young people and brings forth their full capacity. Nigel Lawson is saying that it's dangerous to educate the young too much because then we produce cultivated people who aren't suited to the low-grade jobs the market will offer them. An official at the Department of Education and Science recently said something similar. He said, and I'm here quoting his words, that we're beginning to create aspirations which society cannot match. When young people can't find work which meets their abilities and expectations, then we're only creating frustration with disturbing social consequences. We have to ration educational opportunities so that society can cope with the output of education. People must be educated once more to know their place. That's the end of the quote. Well, what have we got here? Something very frightening. We've got a policy of deliberately restricting educational provision so that state schools can produce willing sellers of low-grade labor power. It's hard to imagine a more undemocratic approach to education. And notice that to prefer a democratic distribution of educational opportunity, You don't have to believe that everyone is just as clever as everyone else. Nigel Lawson isn't saying that most people are too dim to benefit from a high level of education. It's precisely because people respond well to education that the problem which worries him arises. You see, there's a lot of talent in almost every human being. You can see it in kids. But in most people, that talent remains undeveloped. Since they haven't had the time and the freedom and the facilities to develop it. Throughout history, only a leisured minority have enjoyed such freedom on the backs of the toiling majority. And that's been unavoidable up to now. But now, it's no longer unavoidable. We have a superb technology which could be used to restrict unwanted labor to a modest place in life. But capitalism doesn't use that technology in a liberating way. It continues to imprison people in largely unfulfilling work, and it shrinks from providing the enriching education which the technology it has created makes possible. Some supporters of British capitalism disagree with Lawson's idea that there's a danger that people will get too much education. They say that what the market now needs is a better trained labor force. Well, whoever's right about that, I'm confident that we shouldn't stake our children's future on the hope that the capitalist market will need what's good for them. The educational system shouldn't be subject to the capricious demands of capitalism, and it shouldn't cater to the tendency of capitalism to treat enormous numbers of people as nothing but sources of profit, and when they can't be profitably exploited, as redundant and expendable, because that's what the capitalist firm does. Is it possible to create a society which goes beyond the unequal treatment that capitalism imposes? Many would say that the idea of such a society is an idle dream. Many would agree with the negative things I've said about capitalism, but they'd say, look, there's no point getting upset about it. There's always been inequality of one kind or another, and there always will be. But I think that reading of history is too pessimistic. There's actually much less inequality now than there was, for instance, 100 years ago. 100 years ago, only a few radicals proposed that everybody should have the vote. Others thought that was a dangerous idea, and most would have considered it to be an unrealistic one. But today, we have the vote. We are a political democracy. But we're not an economic democracy. We don't share our material resources. And most people in this country would regard that as an unrealistic idea. Yet I'm sure it's an idea whose time will come. Society won't always be divided into those who control its resources and those who have only their own labor to sell. But it'll take a lot of thought to work out the design of a democratic economic order, and it'll take a lot of struggle against privilege and power to bring it about. We can't go back to being independent peasant communities, and even if we could, we'd be sacrificing the tremendous gains we owe to capitalism if we did so. Nor is anybody going to provide us with schmooze. The obstacles to economic democracy are considerable. But just as no one now would defend slavery or serfdom, I believe that a day will come when no one will be able to defend a form of society in which a minority profit from the dispossession of the majority.
You got a smile so bright. You know you could have been a candle. I'm holding you so tight. You know you could have been a handle. The way you swept me off my feet. You know you could have been a broom. The way you smell so sweet. You know you could have been some perfume. Well, you could have been anything that you wanted to. And I can tell. The way you do the things you do.
The way you do the things you do. The way you do the things you do.
As pretty as you are. You know you could have been a flower. If good looks was a minute, you know that you could be an hour. The way you stole my heart, you know you could have been a cool crook. And baby, you're so smart, you know you could have been a school book. Well, you could have been anything that you wanted to, and I can tell the way you do the things you do,
the way you do the things you do,
baby,
the way you do the things you do.
You made my life so rich. You know you could have been some money. And baby, you're so sweet. You know you could have been some honey. Well, you could have been anything that you wanted to, and I can tell the way you do the things you do.
The way you do the things you do.
You really swept me off my feet.
The way you do the things you do.
You made my life complete.
The way you do the things you do.
You made my life so bright.
The way you do the things you do.
You make me feel alright.
The way you do the things you do.
You make me feel alright.
Do you have one of these? I got a little obsessed with mine. In fact, I got a little obsessed with all my stuff. Have you ever wondered where all the stuff we buy comes from and where it goes when we throw it out? I couldn't stop wondering about that, so I looked it up. And what the textbook said is that stuff moves through a system from extraction to production to distribution to consumption to disposal. Altogether, it's called the materials economy. Well, I looked into it a little bit more. In fact, I spent 10 years traveling the world, tracking where our stuff comes from and where it goes. And you know what I found out? That is not the whole story. There is a lot missing from this explanation. For one thing, this system looks like it's fine, no problem. But the truth is, it's a system in crisis. And the reason it's a system in crisis is it's a linear system, and we live on a finite planet, and you cannot run a linear system on a finite planet indefinitely. Every step along the way, this system is interacting with the real world. In real life, it's not happening on a blank white page. It's interacting with societies, cultures, economies, the environment. And all along the way, it's bumping up against limits. Limits we don't see here because the diagram is incomplete. So let's go back through. Let's fill in some of the blanks and see what's missing. Well, one of the most important things that's missing is people. Yes, people. People live and work all along this system. And some people in this system matter a little more than others. Some have a little more say. Who are they? Well, let's start with the government. Now, my friends tell me I should use a tank to symbolize the government, and that's true in many countries and increasingly in our own. After all, more than 50% of our federal tax money is now going to the military. But I'm using a person to symbolize the government because I hold true to the vision and values that government should be of the people, by the people, for the people. It's the government's job to watch out for us, to take care of us. That's their job. Then along came the corporation. Now, the reason the corporation looks bigger than the government is that the corporation is bigger than the government. Of the 100 largest economies on Earth now, 51 are corporations. And as the corporation has grown in size and power, we've seen a little change in the government where they're a little more concerned in making sure everything's working out for those guys than for us. Okay, so let's see what else is missing from this picture. We'll start with extraction, which is a fancy word for natural resource exploitation, which is a fancy word for trashing the planet. What this looks like is we chop down the trees, we blow up mountains to get the metals inside, we use up all the water, and we wipe out the animals. So here, we are running up against our first limit. We are running out of resources. We are using too much stuff. Now, I know this can be hard to hear, but it's the truth, so we've got to deal with it. In the past 3 decades alone, 1/3 of the planet's natural resource base has been consumed. Gone. We are cutting and mining and hauling and trashing the place so fast that we're undermining the planet's very ability for people to live here. Where I live, in the United States, we have less than 4% of our original forests left. 40% of the waterways have become undrinkable. And our problem is not just that we're using too much stuff, but we're using more than our share. We have 5% of the world's population, but we're using 30% of the world's resources and creating 30% of the world's waste. If everybody consumed at US rates, we would need 3 to 5 planets. And you know what? We've only got one. So my country's response to this limitation is simply to go take somebody else's. This is the third world, which some would say is another word for our stuff that somehow got on somebody else's land. So what does that look like? The same thing, trashing the place. 75% of global fisheries now are fished at or beyond capacity. 80% of the planet's original forests are gone. In the Amazon alone, we're losing 2,000 trees a minute. That is 7 football fields a minute. And what about the people who live here? Well, according to these guys, they don't own these resources, even if they've been living there for generations. They don't own the means of production, and they're not buying a lot of stuff. And in this system, if you don't own or buy a lot of stuff, you don't have value. So next, the materials move to production. And what happens there is we use energy to mix toxic chemicals in with the natural resources to make toxic contaminated products. There are over 100,000 synthetic chemicals in use in commerce today. Only a handful of them have even been tested for health impacts, and none have been tested for synergistic health impacts. That means when they interact with all the other chemicals we're exposed to every day. So we don't know the full impact on health and the environment of all these toxic chemicals, but we do know one thing. Toxics in, toxics out. As long as we keep putting toxics into our industrial production systems, we're going to keep getting toxics in the stuff that we bring into our homes and workplaces and schools, and duh, our bodies. Like BFRs, brominated flame retardants, they're a chemical that make things more fireproof, but they are super toxic. They're a neurotoxin. That means toxic to the brain. What are we even doing using a chemical like this? Yet we put it in our computers, our appliances, couches, mattresses, even some pillows. In fact, we take our pillows, we douse them in a neurotoxin, then we bring them home and put our heads on them for 8 hours a night to sleep. Now, I don't know, but it seems to me in this country with so much potential, we could think of a better way to stop our heads from catching on fire at night. Now, these toxics build up the food chain and concentrate in our bodies. Do you know what is the food at the top of the food chain with the highest level of many toxic contaminants? Human breast milk. That means that we've reached a point where the smallest members of our societies, our babies, are getting the highest lifetime dose of toxic chemicals from breastfeeding from their mothers. Is that not an incredible violation? Breastfeeding must be the most fundamental human act of nurturing. It should be sacred and safe. Now, breastfeeding is still best, and mothers should definitely keep breastfeeding, but we should protect it. They should protect it. I thought they were looking out for us. And of course, the people who bear the biggest brunt of these toxic chemicals are the factory workers, many of whom are women of reproductive age. They're working with reproductive toxins, carcinogens, and more. Now, I ask you, what kind of woman of reproductive age would work in a job exposed to reproductive toxins except for a woman with no other option? And that's one of the beauties of this system. The erosion of local environments and economies here ensures a constant supply of people with no other option. Globally, 200,000 people a day are moving from environments that have sustained them for generations into cities, many to live in slums, looking for work, no matter how toxic that work may be. So you see, it's not just resources that are wasted along this system, but people too. Whole communities get wasted. Yep, toxics in, toxics out. A lot of the toxics leave the factories in products, but even more leave as byproducts or pollution. And it's a lot of pollution. In the U.S., our industry admits to releasing over 4 billion pounds of toxic chemicals a year. And it's probably a lot more, because that's only what they admit. So that's another limit, because yuck, who wants to look at and smell 4 billion pounds of toxic chemicals a year? So what do? Move the dirty factories overseas, pollute someone else's land. But surprise, a lot of that pollution is coming right back at us, carried by wind currents. So what happens after all these natural resources are turned into products? Well, it moves here for distribution. Now, distribution means selling all the toxic contaminated junk as quickly as possible. The goal here is to keep the prices down, keep the people buying, and keep the inventory moving. How do they keep the prices down? Well, they don't pay the store workers very much, and they skimp on health insurance every time they can. It's all about externalizing the costs. What that means is that the real costs of making stuff aren't captured in the price. In other words, we aren't paying for the stuff we buy. I was thinking about this the other day. I was walking to work and I wanted to listen to the news, so I popped into a Radio Shack to buy a radio. I found this cute little green radio for $4.99. I was standing there in line to buy this thing and I was thinking, how could $4.99 possibly capture the cost of making this radio and getting it into my hands? The metal was probably mined in South Africa. The petroleum was probably drilled in Iraq. The plastics were probably produced in China, and maybe the whole thing was assembled by some 15-year-old in a maquilador in Mexico. $4.99 wouldn't even pay the rent for the shelf space it occupied until I came along, let alone part of the staff guy's salary who helped me pick it out, or the multiple ocean cruises and truck rides pieces of this radio went on. That's how I realized I didn't pay for the radio. So who did pay? Well, these people paid with the loss of their natural resource space. These people paid with the loss of their clean air, with increasing asthma and cancer rates. Kids in the Congo paid with their future. 30% of the kids in the Congo now have dropped out of school to mine coltan, a metal we need for our cheap and disposable electronics. These people even paid by having to cover their own health insurance. All along this system, people pitched in so I could get this radio for $4.99, and none of these contributions are recorded in any accounts book. That's what I mean by the company owners externalize the true costs of production. And that brings us to the golden arrow of consumption. This is the heart of the system, the engine that drives it. It is so important that protecting this arrow has become the top priority for both of these guys. That's why after 9/11, when our country was in shock and President Bush could have suggested any number of appropriate things, to grieve, to pray, to hope, no, he said to shop, to shop. We have become a nation of consumers. Our primary identity has become that of being consumers, not mothers, teachers, farmers, but consumers. The primary way that our value is measured and demonstrated is by how much we contribute to this arrow, how much we consume. And do we? We shop and shop and shop, keep the materials flowing, and flow they do. Guess what percentage of total materials flow through this system is still in product or use 6 months after their date of sale in North America? 50%? 20? No. 1%. One. In other words, 99% of the stuff we harvest, mine, process, transport, 99% of the stuff we run through this system is trashed within 6 months. Now, how can we run a planet with that level of materials throughput? It wasn't always like this. The average U.S. person now consumes twice as much as they did 50 years ago. Ask your grandma. In her day, stewardship and resourcefulness and thrift were valued. So how did this happen? Well, it didn't just happen. It was designed. Shortly after World War II, these guys were figuring out how to ramp up the economy. Retailing analyst Victor Lebeau articulated the solution that's become the norm for the whole system. He said, our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, replaced, and discarded at an ever-accelerating rate. President Eisenhower's Council of Economic Advisers chairman said that the American economy's ultimate purpose is to produce more consumer goods. More consumer goods? Our ultimate purpose? Not provide health care or education or safe transportation or sustainability or justice? Consumer goods? How did they get us to jump on board this program so enthusiastically? Well, two of their most effective strategies are planned obsolescence and perceived obsolescence. Planned obsolescence is another word for designed for the dump. It means they actually make stuff to be useless as quickly as possible, so we'll chuck it and buy a new one. It's obvious with things like plastic bags and coffee cups, but now it's even big stuff. Mops, DVDs, cameras, barbecues even, everything. Even computers. Have you noticed that when you buy a computer now, the technology is changing so fast that in just a couple of years, it's actually an impediment to communication? I was curious about this, so I opened up a big desktop computer to see what was inside. And I found out that the piece that changes each year is just a tiny little piece in the corner. But you can't just change that one piece because each new version is a different shape. So you gotta chuck the whole thing and buy a new one. So I was reading industrial design journals from the 1950s when planned obsolescence was really catching on. These designers are so open about it. They actually discuss how fast can they make stuff break that still leaves the consumer having enough faith in the product to go out and buy another one. It was so intentional. But stuff cannot break fast enough to keep this arrow afloat. So there's also perceived obsolescence. Now, perceived obsolescence convinces us to throw away stuff that is still perfectly useful. How do they do that? Well, they change the way the stuff looks. So if you bought your stuff a couple of years ago, everyone can tell that you haven't contributed to this arrow recently. And since the way we demonstrate our value is contributing to this arrow, it can be embarrassing. Like, I've had the same fat white computer monitor on my desk for 5 years. My coworker just got a new computer. She has a flat, shiny, sleek monitor. It matches her computer, it matches her phone, even her pen stand. She looks like she's driving in Spaceship Central, and I look like I've got a washing machine on my desk. Fashion is another prime example of this. Have you ever wondered why women's shoe heels go from fat one year to skinny the next to fat to skinny? It's not because there's some debate about which heel structure is the most healthy for women's feet. It's because wearing fat heels in a skinny heel year shows everybody that you haven't contributed to that arrow as recently, so you're not as valuable as that person in skinny heels next to you, or more likely in some ad. It's to keep us buying new shoes. Advertisements and media in general plays a big role in this. Each of us in the U.S. is targeted with over 3,000 advertisements a day. We see more advertisements in 1 year than people 50 years ago saw in a lifetime. And if you think about it, what's the point of an ad except to make us unhappy with what we have? So 3,000 times a day, we're told our hair is wrong, our skin is wrong, our clothes are wrong, our furniture is wrong, our car is wrong, we are wrong, but it can all be made right if we just go shopping. Media also helps by hiding all of this and all of this. So the only part of the materials economy we see is the shopping. The extraction, production, and disposal all happens outside of our field of vision. So in the U.S., we have more stuff than ever before. But polls show that our national happiness is actually declining. Our national happiness peaked in the 1950s, the same time that this consumption mania exploded. Interesting coincidence. I think I know why. We have more stuff, but we have less time for the things that really make us happy. Friends, family, leisure time. We're working harder than ever. Some analysts say we have less leisure time than any time since feudal society. And do you know what the two main activities are that we do with the scant leisure time we have? Watch TV and shop. In the US, we spend 3 to 4 times as many hours shopping as our counterparts in Europe do. So we're in this ridiculous situation where we go to work, maybe 2 jobs even, and we come home and we're exhausted, so we plop down on our new couch and watch TV, and the commercials tell us you suck, so you gotta go to the mall to buy something to feel better, and then you gotta go to work more to pay for the stuff you just bought, so you come home and you're more tired, so you sit down and you watch more TV, and it tells you to go to the mall again, and we're on this crazy work, watch, spend treadmill, and we could just stop. So in the end, what happens to all the stuff we buy anyway? At this rate of consumption, it can't fit into our houses, even though the average house size has doubled in this country since the 1970s. It all goes out in the garbage. And that brings us to disposal. This is the part of the materials economy we all know the most because we have to haul the junk out to the curb ourselves. Each of us in the United States makes 4.5 pounds of garbage a day. That's twice what we each made 30 years ago. All of this garbage either gets dumped in a landfill, which is just a big hole in the ground, or if you're really unlucky, first it's burned in an incinerator and then dumped in the landfill. Either way, they both pollute the air, land, water, and don't forget, change the climate. Incineration is really bad. Remember those toxics back in the production stage? Well, burning the garbage releases the toxics up into the air. Even worse, it makes new super toxics, like dioxin. Dioxin is the most toxic man-made substance known to science, and incinerators are the number one toxin. That means that we could stop the number one source of the most toxic man-made substance known just by stopping burning the trash. We could stop it today. Now, some companies don't want to deal with building landfills and incinerators here, so they just export the disposal, too. What about recycling? Does recycling help? Yes, recycling helps. Recycling reduces the garbage at this end, and it reduces the pressure to mine and harvest new stuff at this end. Yes, 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 we should all recycle. But recycling is not enough. Recycling will never be enough, for a couple reasons. First, the waste coming out of our houses is just the tip of the iceberg. For every one garbage can of waste you put out on the curb, 70 garbage cans of waste were made upstream just to make the junk in that one garbage can you put out on the curb. So even if we could recycle 100% of the waste coming out of our households, it doesn't get to the core of the problems. Also, much of the garbage can't be recycled, either because it contains too many toxics or it's designed not to be recyclable in the first place. Like those juice packs, where they have layers of metal and paper and plastic all smushed together. You can never separate those for true recycling. So you see, it is a system in crisis. All along the way, we are bumping up against limits. From changing climate to declining happiness, it's just not working. But the good thing about such an all-pervasive problem is that there are so many points of intervention. There are people working here on saving forests and here on clean production, people working on labor rights and fair trade and conscious consuming and blocking landfills and incinerators, and very importantly, on taking back our government so that it really is by the people and for the people. All of this work is critically important, but things are really going to start moving when we see the connections, when we see the big picture. When people along this system get united, we can reclaim and transform this linear system into something new, a system that doesn't waste resources or people. Because what we really need to chuck is that old school throwaway mindset. There's a new school of thinking on this stuff, and it's based on sustainability and equity, green chemistry, zero waste, closed loop production, renewable energy, local living economies. It's already happening. Now, some say it's unrealistic. Idealistic that it can't happen, but I say the ones who are unrealistic are those that want to continue with the old path. That's dreaming. Remember, that old way didn't just happen. It's not like gravity that we've just got to live with. People created it, and we're people too. So let's create something new.
Sunshine on a cloudy day. When it's cold outside, I've got the month of May. I guess you'll say, what can make me feel this way, my girl?
My girl.
My girl.
Talking about my girl.
My girl.
I've got so much honey, the bees envy me. I've got a sweeter song than the birds in the trees. Well, I guess you say, what can make me feel this way, my girl?
My girl.
My girl.
Talking about my girl.
My girl.
Ooh, ooh.
Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey.
Ooh, yeah. I don't need no money, fortune, or fame. I've got all the riches, baby, one man can claim. Well, I guess you'll say, what can make me feel this way, my girl?
My girl.
My girl.
Talking about my girl.
My girl. Talking about my girl.
I've got sunshine on a cloudy day with my girl. I've even got the month of May with my girl.
My girl.
talking about my girl. Ooh, my girl.